from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another day, another round of Saudi bombing raids on Yemen, with more than 4 weeks of daily poundings of that impoverished nation. We begin with this report from Press TV's Khaniz Fatima.
Saudi Arabia continues to bomb Yemen. The country has been hit by more than 25 airstrikes over the past few hours alone, with 20 attacks targeting the southern city of Aden. It's the third consecutive day of Saudi airstrikes, which were resumed following Riyadh's announcement of an end to its aerial campaign against Yemen. At least 23 people have been killed since the attacks were resumed. This brings the total death to at least 2,750 since Saudi Arabia began bombing Yemen on March the 26th. Most of the casualties are civilians. Riyadh says its airstrikes are aimed at reinstating fugitive former President Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi. It claims the attacks target military positions of the Ansarullah and their allies. On the ground, however, civilian areas and Yemen's infrastructure have been hit hard.
The violence in Yemen has killed at least 115 children in the past month, according to some UN agencies Friday. UNICEF said that 71 children were killed in the north and 44 in the south since late March. Meanwhile, the UN's food and health agencies spoke of widespread fuel shortages, which risked disrupting aid deliveries and life-saving work in hospitals. For more, we have this report from Daniel Johnson.
In a bleak assessment of the situation in Yemen, UNICEF made a plea to warring parties to respect international law and protect children. Spokesperson Christophe Bouliorac told journalists in Geneva that its estimate of 115 children killed was in reality almost certainly higher.
UNICEF demand that urgent action be taken to end grave violations against children. All parties to the conflict must protect children at all times. Neither target nor use schools and hospitals.
As renewed fighting enters its fifth week between government forces and Houthi rebels, the Children's Agency reported that 30 schools have been damaged or occupied and 23 hospitals attacked. UN agency World Health Organization, meanwhile, expressed alarm at fuel shortages which threatened the transport of already scarce medical supplies and vaccines. And World Food Programme said it had enough fuel for 2 weeks, though the shortages were already affecting families who had nothing to cook with. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
A call for closer ties between Africa and Asia by the head of the African Union. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe spoke at the conference in Indonesia Thursday. He called on Asia, in particular China, to help develop the infrastructure of Africa using the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank as a model.
Excellencies, the past 30 years, trade flows between our two regions have increased rapidly, but in a highly imbalanced way. In 2013, for example, Asia accounted for 26% of Africa's trade flows, whereas Africa accounted for a mere 3% of Asia's flows. One of the major factors accounting for this skewed trade imbalance is that Africa-Asia trade patterns have replicated those between Africa and the developed countries. Africa's exports are dominated by raw commodities, while its imports are dominated by manufactured goods. We can and must correct this unsustainable situation. African countries have thus decided to transform their economies through resource-based, value-added industrialization programs and projects. This economic transformation agenda offers immense opportunities for deeper cooperation between our countries. We thus invite our friends in Asia, many of whom already have a significant presence in many of our countries, to partner us in our industrialization projects through the beneficiation of and value addition to the natural resources as abundantly available throughout the African continent, to enhance the process of integration on the continent through constructing, rehabilitating, and improving transport, energy, telecommunication, and other infrastructure. The Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, examples of the way and manner we ought to forge ahead if the voice of the South is going to matter in international areas and international affairs.
Another major step was announced in the continuing development of ties between Russia and Latin America. Argentina and the Russian Federation announced the signing of a number of major agreements in the energy sector Thursday. The two countries also announced expanded military and technological ties. In particular, Russia's President Vladimir Putin said he will expedite the development for Argentina of the GLONASS satellite navigation system, an alternative to GPS, a global positioning and navigation system using satellite imaging. Putin also backed Buenos Aires' long-standing claims to the disputed Malvinas Islands just off Argentina's coast, which are claimed by both Argentina and the UK. Press TV's Marina Cordonova reports from Moscow.
Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has visited Russia to boost bilateral ties. The two countries have signed a number of contracts, including an agreement on nuclear energy.
Rosatom has joined the project to build the sixth block of the Atucha nuclear power plant. The implementation of the agreements reached today in this area will provide Argentina the access to the latest Russian technologies that meet the most stringent requirements of nuclear safety.
The increase in bilateral food trade was the second important issue for discussion between the two presidents. In light of souring relations with the West over Ukrainian crisis, Moscow has significantly increased its trade and economic cooperation with the Latin American countries. Argentina is Russia's fourth biggest trading partner after Brazil, Mexico, and Ecuador. Russia-Argentina food trade totaled $1.4 billion last year. Thus, the two countries consulted on using national currencies in mutual trade settlements.
We agreed to hold extensive consultations on the question of using national currencies in trade payments between states and between commercial partners.
20 agreements have been signed, ranging from culture to economic development, agriculture, trade, energy projects, military cooperation, and environment. Total value of contracts only in deals on developing hydroelectric, nuclear, and fossil-based energy is about $5 billion. Argentinian president also welcomes the expanding ties.
Otro paso más.
Through these contracts, Argentina will join the group of 10 countries which can produce and engineer the nuclear reactors. This will allow us to have clean, transparent energy, which cannot be subject to fluctuation in the world market.
Russian president said Moscow stands for a quick and peaceful settlement of the dispute between Argentina and Britain on the issue of the Malvinas Islands.
This is the third visit of Cristina Kirchner to Russia as the head of state. This year marks 130th anniversary of diplomatic relations between Russia and Argentina. Marina Kartonova, Press TV, Moscow.
The U.S. military this week staged the largest joint war games with the Philippines in 15 years, leaving many in the region asking why. Philippines President Benigno Aquino has insisted the drills are not directed at China, despite rising tensions over territorial disputes in the South China Sea. But some experts disagree, calling the drills a direct message to Beijing. One such expert is Renato Reyes Jr., Secretary General of the Philippines' New Patriotic Front, or BAYAN. He spoke with CCTV's Tian Wei about the drills.
Right now, let me state for the record that we are opposed to China's claims and incursions in what we believe to be the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. We are also opposed to the idea that our salvation, that our only hope of countering China, is to hang on to Uncle Sam and allow the renewed presence of bases and more U.S. troops in our territory. So we prefer to pursue our claims via the peaceful route. That's why we support the filing before the ITLOS. However, right now, the complication is that the U.S. is trying to assert itself, trying to justify the establishment of its bases and more troops in our country under the pretext of protecting us against China.
While the U.S. has massed such record numbers of military assets in the Pacific for the drills, it has also massed huge numbers of military assets to Russia's western borders for war games in East Europe and deployed an elite airborne squad to Ukraine, ostensibly for training purposes. To sort through all of that, we spoke with our geopolitical analyst, Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international relations and security at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow Friday. Mark, the U.S. has all kinds of military assets, more or less right up to the borders of Russia on the west, including U.S. troops now in western Ukraine. What's going on?
Yes, most recently and most immediately to the concerns certainly of East Ukrainians and Russians is that the U.S. has deployed 800 paratroopers from the 173rd Airborne, usually based in Italy, to, quote, train and advise the Ukrainian National Guard supposedly in western Ukraine. Now, it must be noted that they are not there to train the Ukrainian military, the Ukrainian army. The Ukrainian army is, by and large, almost completely, mass forced conscripts. Okay? The National Guard, these are the ideologicals of the Maidan, the ultra-nationalists, the fascists, those committed to the fighting to establish the new Ukraine. These are the ones that the United States is training. They are literally training fascists to install, quote, democracy, unquote, right, in Ukraine. And when I say fascists, I'm not joking. You know, just Google Idar or Azov Battalion. Right. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International have criticized them for what they call atrocities and war crimes already in East Ukraine. Even the BBC, the Telegraph have done pieces acknowledging that there's open ideological fascists fighting in these, that's the symbology they use for their units, that there's fascists from around Europe, volunteers fighting in these units, but it doesn't penetrate the narrative. It doesn't sway the overall opinion. It's simply right, brushed aside as inconsequential. If you think the U.S. military training fascists in Ukraine or training Islamists in Syria is inconsequential.
Right. I mean, the BBC has to admit it when these people come to the interviews wearing basically swastika armbands.
Yeah, The Guardian was incredibly embarrassed when they did a puff piece on one of these girls, and then they had to later admit when challenged that the photo they took of her standing in front of the van had the numbers 88, which is neo-Nazi code for Heil Hitler, on the van, and there was one other piece of neo-Nazi symbology as well. And that was in complete denial of what The Guardian was actually writing about this person. Yeah. So 800 U.S. paratroopers, a couple hundred Brits, 100 Canadians, and an undisclosed number of Polish military trainers on the way. But the Russian Defense Ministry already announced yesterday that supposedly these military trainers and advisors are suddenly no longer just in West Ukraine, that they are now in Eastern Ukraine, in the combat zone, in the Donbass.
Whoa.
For your American viewers, I'm ex-U.S. military, right? I don't wish harm on any particular American troops. I simply don't want them in eastern Ukraine where they have no business and where I have family.
Right.
Especially not training Nazis or ultra-nationalists or what have you. Mm. What happens? Answer me this, Don. What happens when the first American
comes home
from Ukraine. Right. To Dover Air Force Base in a flag-draped coffin,
right,
killed by an Eastern Ukrainian depicted as a pro-Russian separatist, or God forbid, a Russian volunteer.
Right.
What happens?
Well, you know,
what happens then, Don?
That, well, we know how that plays out, because unlike when the troops come home dead from Afghanistan and Iraq and the media is locked out of that, there,
yes,
will be a media circus around this, and look at Wag the Dog, basically, for your model. You know, that, yeah, it troubles me that that's happening, but you know what's more troubling? This airborne group is an elite group, and it is,
yes,
the self-same group that if the U.S. decided it was going to invade Russia, that's who they would send, the same guys. And now,
I mean,
now they're right there.
Yeah, these guys are elite guys, but they're not fabulous trainers. They're not specific, you know, from training rates whose job is to train. They,
right,
don't speak Ukrainian.
Right.
They don't speak Russian, even because even in Ukraine, most Ukrainians speak Russian. So what are they really doing there? I mean, they really,
right,
need to ask yourself. And if you are naive, you will come to a conclusion that they're there for what they say they're there on the surface. But if you are a student at all of history, you can't but be drawn back, I mean, numerous times since then, but Vietnam.
Yeah. It's, I mean, you're saying, basically,
Trainers and advisors.
Right. The first troops, basically. And see,
yes,
I mean, that's what gets me. Okay, you have the function that they serve as being bait for an incident that can be an enabling incident for, you know, further hostilities directly involving the United States. And you also have all this hardware and all these personnel that are massed along the Russian border from, you know, from the Baltic down to the Black Sea, including naval resources, tanks, all kinds of aircraft,
yeah,
everything.
All
deployed.
The U.S. is now stationing hundreds of tanks again in facilities in Norway and Germany.
Right.
Hundreds of tanks.
Right. I mean, and it's not because they don't have a parking lot somewhere,
yeah,
else. And what gets me? Okay, so you have all this hardware in position to fight. They're conducting maneuvers, war games, whatever. And now you have, you know, the first shock troops, basically, that the U.S. would use are already based now in Ukraine, 800 of them. And
yeah,
then pivot to the east. The largest war games and maneuvers in the last 15 years by the U.S. are taking place simultaneously. And that goes right up to it goes to China, but it also goes right up to the eastern part of Russia.
Yeah, and of course it's not a coincidence, because the Chinese and the Russian navies regularly have military drills together now. And the reason for that is because the U.S. has pushed Russia to it.
Mm.
I mean, I don't regret that personally. I think strategic defensive alliance with China makes sense for Russia's interests.
For sure,
I think it makes good sense for the world's interests.
Right.
If we don't want the U.S. running around the world, getting its young men and women killed in places that they don't belong in and don't deserve to be killed in. This is escalation on top of provocation on top of escalation on top of provocation, and this is very, very far from American shores.
Yeah, about as far as you can get.
And very, very, very extended and neoconish interpretations of U.S. national interests.
Okay, so then meanwhile, this happens in the context, or these other things happen within this context. Last week we saw and we discussed the transfer of S-400s to China and S-300s,
yes,
to Iran. And then yesterday we saw that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner from Argentina and President Putin reaching a broad set of agreements that range from technology transfers to military cooperation. And, you know, there are similar moves going on throughout Latin America. I know also that Nicaragua is involved in those kinds of discussions. That was released yesterday, that President Ortega is involved in discussions with Russia about military cooperation.
Venezuela, Ecuador.
Yeah. And so,
Brazilian military cooperation.
Are we seeing an emerging alternative bloc?
I was just going to say we're seeing bloc formation. This is back to military bloc formation. I mean, Russia and the U.S. are the number one and number two. The U.S. first, Russia the number two biggest arms sellers in the world, but they haven't been specifically in this return to Cold War style arming of opposite sides and blocks since 92, and we're back to that once again.
Yeah, you know, and there's some interesting things. There was a conversation with the Foreign Minister Lavrov the other day, that television thing that he did, and he was asked about a variety of different military armament and basing strategies, if they were going to seek military bases elsewhere and stuff. And it was an interesting response that he gave when he said that we don't need the kind of military bases abroad that the United States has, where you have, say, a naval base with a hardened fortress at the heart of it and, you know, all of this, but rather just, you know, the right to call on ports and, you know, have our Navy out there, basically, and have places to refuel and, you know, let the crew
get some R&R.
And stuff. And as we see this block formation happening on these rather, you know, less intensive terms, but perhaps equally productive terms, if you think of the old map, before the split between Soviet Union and People's Republic of China, even when you had like one block, it was still from China, say, to Poland. And it was all, you know, it was localized with the exception of Cuba. Yep. Now you're looking at an entirely different map of China, India, Russia, almost all of Latin America and the Caribbean, for example, and a number of other Asian countries that are either looking to stay neutral or realize that they need some sort of protection from the U.S. And you're seeing that also in places like Iran, Syria, and elsewhere. So as they choose up the new blocks, it's a different configuration on a global map. You think?
Yeah, it's really a kind of a return to what is the supposed worst nightmare of American geopoliticians. The formation of a Eurasian bloc in the what is called, in Mackinder's terms, the world island, that will, if we want to use military parlance, deny access to the United States military. And denying access means they can't come in with their militaries, with their bombing to enforce political solutions on other countries in Eurasia. But that is the worst fear of U.S. geopoliticians. I mean, the heart of it, of course, being the Sino-Russian strategic alliance. And the U.S. keeps doing everything possible, it seems, to keep pushing a Russia that didn't want to become that close to China. Let's go back to 2000. Putin was seen as a pro-Western liberalizer, a tool of the oligarchs, and he was the first one to call and commiserate with George Bush after 9/11. This Putin is not the Putin that he wanted to be. He's the Putin that events and U.S. actions around the world, from Iraq to Syria to Libya and so on, have forced him to be.
And distinct from Putin, who's only a person after all,
yes.
It's the same. The same is true of Russia in general, and also of China, and also, I mean, you talk about the U.S. seemingly working as hard as they can to create this new bloc. If you look, I mean, what choice, for example, does Venezuela have What choice does Argentina have when you have American courts trying to seize the Argentine treasury, the CIA trying to sting her with this, you know, that Nisman thing? You know, across that whole region, Brazil the same. I mean, what choice does Rusev have?
Yeah, Putin doesn't want, the U.S. doesn't want friends or allies. The U.S. only wants vassal states.
That's right. And for some reason, much of humanity is standing up and saying we don't want to be vassal states at this point in history. And strategic partnership with Russia and China affords that possibility. And it seems that people have become desperate enough that they're seeking it out as, you know, the only opportunity to maintain their sovereignty. And then you saw yesterday Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, is this year also the head of the African Union, and they're having in right now the Asian African Summit in Bandung, you know, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the original Bandung Conference in 1955. And the same, you had Mugabe making a call on China to treat Africa in the same way that, you know, to find a model of development of Africa along the models of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. In other words, an invitation for them to come build our infrastructure with us as partners and help us develop our continent. And as you see the alternative to neoliberalism start to spring up in Africa like you saw in Latin America, you're going to probably start to see a political development like that in Latin America and more allies for Russia, China, and you know, that alternative bloc. What's that leave the United States?
Well, very, very quietly, very much under the radar, Obama has sent military troops now to about two-thirds of sub-Saharan African states or more at this point. Drone bases all over Africa. If you take a look at the map, there is very much a Chinese-U.S. Confrontation going to come down in Africa. And China has made a very strong, has very strong economic interests in Africa. It's a big source of national resources to fuel their economic machine and provide Americans with the consumer garbage that, you know, they need so much from the Chinese. But their supply lines to Africa are vital. And the Chinese pursuit in Africa has been, we don't tell you how to run your country. We don't tell you how to run, you know, your politics. We just want to do business. We're more than happy to help you develop in pursuit of that, but we're not going to tell you how to do it. The U.S., on the other hand, is making its own quiet pivot to Africa, but it almost entirely consists of sending military troops and drones. And we see that the two real strengths of the two countries as they've developed in recent years. The U.S. relies on its military and China relies on its economy.
Yeah, again, Mugabe, he laid out, first of all, that unfortunately to date, the development model that's been followed also by China and others resembles too much the development model of, you know, the colonial powers.
And the Washington Consensus.
Right. And made a plea saying, look, we would love to have you come in and help us build our infrastructure. And as it turns out, globally, what China does is build infrastructure and finance it. That's what they're doing across the globe.
Well, China's been invested in Africa and was all through the Cold War. They were fostering much friendlier, much more equal relations, you know, both part of the developing the Second World at the time. Later, you know, the non-aligned bloc, China was very much on that side. Of course, it's really come on steam in recent years as the Chinese economy has grown by leaps and bounds. And you're right, China absolutely does infrastructure. They do it better than anyone in the world. They're even building American infrastructure. In California, they needed a giant bridge built. They don't actually build bridges like that in the U.S. anymore. So they had it built in China and shipped over in parts to California.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.